Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, special guest again this week, Coastal Carolina coach Jamie Chadwell, the coach of America's team.
Yeah, as fun a story as there was in college football, we're excited to talk to him about his program, his offense, and a lot of other things related to the Chanticleers.
So before we get to that, I just wanted to bring up, you know, look, I think we make the assumption that everybody listens to every episode. That's not true. Some people drop in on this podcast. Maybe they're discovering it for the first time. So people might not be aware, but you and I write for a website called The Athletic. It's a great sports subscription site. And just this week alone, you can go on there and read a great David Ubben column about the Eyes of Texas controversy with the Longhorns. I really enjoyed Josh Kendall's feature on Dawn Staley, the great women's basketball coach there. Just a ton of college football stories in a pretty slow time of year. And by the way, if you haven't subscribed yet, we've got this special code we can hook you up with, theathletic.com/theaudible. Right now, $3.99 a month. That's, I believe, a 40% discount. theathletic.com/theaudible. Anyway, Bruce, you had a story the other day that I want you to talk about a little bit. I think when people hear about analytics and sports science, it can scare them off a little bit. It can seem a little wonky, but I thought you did a good job.
It scared you off, didn't it? Be honest.
It scared me off for a little bit, but then I read it. I enjoyed it. And I guess basically, like, you know, this would normally be when we have the NFL Combine. And you love the NFL Combine. Let's be honest.
I do love the NFL Combine.
You love the NFL Combine.
Everything about the NFL Combine.
I'm somebody who thinks it's pretty silly. And in particular, the amount of emphasis this sport continues to place on how guys in shorts run a 40 time. There's a quote in your article that really, like, hit me over the head. Like, really? Is this possible? That basically, this technology you write about here could basically replace what they do with the Combine.
Yeah, I think really what it gets to is, I think there will always be guys running the 40, but I think it's going to be how much real emphasis are NFL people, scouts, personnel people really going to place on that, where now because of the data, not just GPS data, but there's a lot of other tracking data that you can get on athletes. So it's not just about what they run in a 40 or what their top end speed, but very, very position specific things that translate on the field. If the right data scientists can basically construct and format what people are looking for. So this company I wrote about was called Breakaway Data. And Dave Anderson, who played for the Texans, was a receiver for them, also was a great player at Colorado State. He's in their Hall of Fame. I don't know if our listeners will remember him from back then, but he would always be kind of wired to, as he put it, a wonder why guy. And as he thought about it, you know, one of the best parts of his career was the 2 years that Kyle Shanahan became the offensive coordinator with the Texans. And he said, Kyle Shanahan really was great at putting me in positions where I'm best. And so that got him thinking further down the road. He went to USC to get his MBA, and then he worked for a company called Second Spectrum, which I know a lot of readers of The Athletic will be familiar with Second Spectrum because it's really a pioneering analytics company that the NBA is involved with. So after Dave got out of there, he worked with another NFL former coach and executive. And what they really kind of took from that, and they developed, the XFL was very proactive. They wanted to create their own combine drills. And so that's one of the things they did. And you can see one of the drills that we've embedded into the story on The Athletic. The Dodgers, who are really out in front on the analytics side of things, they are backing this company, Breakaway Data. And so it's going to have a much bigger role. It's crazy because our story went up on Monday And I heard from a half dozen people inside football, including a couple of Power Five programs, saying, "Hey, can you pass along somebody, Dave's number, because we want to reach out to him." And to see the reaction, because there is a lot of people who are very curious about this. Now, Alabama, Nick Saban, a year ago, really went all in on this field that, you know, is largely called performance science. Nick Saban hired two what people normally would think of as or categorize as strength coaches into that category, but there really were more than that. Dr. Matt Rhea fits into that category of performance science. And actually, he has a connection to the Dodgers head of it, Brandon McDaniel, who studied under him. So it's fascinating to see. And now that Nick Saban has given this field really his stamp of approval and bought all in, well, it'll be really interesting to see that now a lot of college head coaches are probably going to be a lot more receptive to it.
Remember a year ago when everybody was freaking out because Scott Cochran, Nick Saban's strength coach since day one at Alabama, left for Georgia. What's this going to mean for the program? And I remember when he announced his replacement was coming from Indiana. I remember this is pre-Indiana breakout season last year. I was like, huh, that's kind of an unconventional choice. But Najee, you talked to Najee Harris in this story, and he talked, pretty candidly about how much that those, that change in approach really helped him blossom as a senior.
Yeah, and I think some of the things specifically, Charles Huff, who had been his position coach, who by the way was Saquon's position coach at Penn State, talked about how athletes, especially today, kids are more tangible. They need to see it. And with some of these things, it's like, hey, all right, you ran 20, your top end when you broke out on this big run at practice, you hit 21 miles per hour. Now he's like, I'm going to try to hit 21.1, 21.2. I know what that feels like. And all of a sudden, it's like it really resonates with a lot of these high-level athletes. And also, it's how you can specifically, in some cases, as Dave Anderson was saying, you can kind of re-engineer and retrain secondary muscle groups depending on what positions and what role in an offense or in a defense you play, because of what they've determined on from the science part of it. It's fascinating to see, because he was like, for these high level athletes, you really can train their bodies like a high performance race car into that level of detail. And that's kind of blows some people's minds when you think about where this is likely can all be headed.
All right, well, let's bring on our guest. I actually own a Coastal Carolina Chanticleers t-shirt that I purchased kind of spontaneously because after that BYU Coastal game last year, I was just got so caught up in it, so excited. And I love teal. So I did not mention that to him on this interview, but we did. It's a fun interview. We both really enjoyed watching their run last season. And we talked to Jamie about that and also the very unique offense that he runs. By the way, that's another story on The Athletic this week, a deep dive film analysis of what makes Coastal's offense so unique. Again, theathletic.com/theaudible, $3.99 a month for 6 months. Let's go to our interview.
All right, Stu, we are now pleased to be joined by our guest, Jamie Chadwell, who just had an amazing year at Coastal Carolina. And everything we've heard is that they're just getting started over there. So, Coach, thanks for joining us today on the Audible.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much.
First night of the college football season, back when we didn't know, like the Big Ten wasn't playing yet, the Pac-12 wasn't playing, we didn't know what this weird, pandemic football season was going to look like. There's no Pac-12 late night game. You guys are playing Kansas on, I think, FS1, and you're clobbering them. And I'm like, who are these guys, right? Like, sorry to confess that I hadn't watched a Coastal Carolina game before that, but I mean, I knew you had beaten Kansas the year before. I hadn't seen it, and you got the great uniforms. You've got this exciting offense. You've got this freshman quarterback who's playing great. So that was the beginning of a really special season for you guys. When did you realize you might have that kind of team, and did it have anything to do with the fact that you were, I think, the only or one of the only teams in the country that got in an entire set of spring practices last year?
Well, and I only say this about that Kansas thing too. You know, people think your first game, you know, you're excited. There's a little pressure. There was a lot of pressure for there because the Sun Belt had won two games that day versus the Big 12. And I knew, and our team knew, hey, we're going to have a lot of people watching us because they want to see if we can sweep the Big 12. So that game took on a little bit more added importance than it normally would have. You know what? I felt like I knew we weren't as bad as, you know, prognosticators said we were and what we got voted. I felt like we were closer in 2019 to having a solid season, having a bowl-type season. You know, we lost five games by 24 points. Now, we were 5-7, but five of those losses we by a total of 24 points. We were close, and so I felt like we were going to be better. I think when I knew we were going to be a special team, we on a Wednesday night on national television, we beat Louisiana, who was, you know, preseason one or two in our league, which is a good program. And then, but our quarterback got hurt and was missing the next game, and we played a Georgia Southern team who's traditionally pretty good. And we were able to beat them with our backup quarterback. And we didn't miss a beat. Nobody panicked and all those things. And I think at that point as a coach, you know, our team's got something about them. They've got those intangible pieces, qualities that a team needs to have to try to, you know, make a special run. And I think that's when I realized, hey, we got a chance. But I do believe getting in the spring practice, you know, we got it. We were finished last year, March 5th was when we finished. I think that's the third day of 2020. And we went on spring break after that. And I hardly know those 15 practices helped us lay a foundation, helped us see what Grayson was about, helped us see what some other people were about. And getting that in, I think, benefited us in a great way because the NCAA passed all those rules in the summer where basically you were able to make it up in a walkthrough way and some of those things. But we were already ahead. So during that walkthrough time, it wasn't us really trying to install XYZ. We were actually building on things that we've done and was able to really, you know, continue to build off of that spring. So I think it was valuable for us to do it and have it. And I think that really did help us have or be prepared more so for a type of season that we went through with the pandemic and missing. You're going to miss practices. You're going to miss certain people. Having that spring, that foundation, and was definitely beneficial to us.
Jamie, we had a story on The Athletic this week done by Ted Wynn. It was X and O's analysis. It was a pretty interesting deep dive into your offensive system, which has gotten a lot of buzz around college football. And I would encourage our readers to check it out. I was on the phone with a coach for something else. I was basically talking to him about some draft prospects. And I had mentioned we were going to have you on our podcast. And I said, how similar is this offense really compared to some other stuff you've seen as the defensive coordinator? And he said, it's kind of insane. He goes, because you got this option-based principles with these insane RPOs coming off them. And he said, they're really good at making in-game adjustments. He's like, what they're doing is they're not just calling plays. And so, you know, I've talked to Willie Korn, who some Clemson fans will definitely remember the name. And if you follow recruiting, people will remember Willie's name. He was a really touted quarterback who went to Clemson. And now he's working with you on the offensive side of the ball. I'm curious as to how you came about with you guys came up with this offense and how, like, what was the brainchild behind it, but also the evolution of it as it's come to be where you're go, hey, we're going to take a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but also we're going to be true to what we're going to do. Cause it feels like everybody's trying to reinvent the wheel now with a lot of this stuff.
Well, you know, part of it started truthfully out of necessity. You know, when I was in college, I played at East Tennessee State. We were an I team back then, draw pass, all that, threw it around a little bit. And then our head coach left, and the offensive coordinator from Air Force came in, and he kind of dabbled with what we were doing and some of his Air Force principles. And so I remembered that. We weren't great at it by any means, but I remembered it. And then sort of forgot it and then learned some West Coast systems from a guy that I worked for. And then when I got my first head job at North Greenville, Division II school, we were playing in a 36 scholarship league and we had 17 scholarships. And I knew if I wanted to try to run an offense that a lot of other people did, it was going to be very challenging to get the type of players you need. And so I'd remembered, you know, obviously what I played under in college a little bit. I went and visited somebody that was doing some option principles, but they were doing it out of the gun. I didn't want to be your traditional military style. I didn't want to be one of those that was under center all the time. I wanted to try to throw the ball. I was a quarterback, but also knew I had to give ourselves a chance to win each week. And so We took some option-based principles and said, hey, this is how we're going to do our run game, and try to mix at that time, try to mix some West Coast type throwing things with some timing and some of those things. And that started in 2009. Willie came and played for me and started in 2010. So I was able to open it up a little bit with him. And then, you know, what happens, you see the evolution of the game. Then we started doing some spread, you know, no huddles type stuff, and then the RPO games. But what we always wanted to do, our foundation, and no matter what we do, no matter how many great plays there are, we always try to base things with our option mind and principle. Say, hey, we're going to be able to run these certain plays from our option standpoint, and we're going to make the defense defend them. And then when I do that, then I know what my answers can be. And then instead of the answer being maybe another run play, net, maybe it's an RPO off of this, or maybe it's, you know, something off of this. And that's how we've tried to continue to build it and evolve. But I never wanted to lose what gives us a chance each week. I mean, you can look at our team this past year, and, you know, we were 6'2", 5'11", 5'9", 6 foot, and 6'2" at our offensive line. We had nobody over, you know, from that standpoint, over 6'2" in height. And so, and three guys truthfully under 6 feet. Now, I'm not telling you that's by design, but that's what we had to try to go win with. And so I have to give them a chance to win each week by leverage and angles. And so we never wanted to lose our identity from that, but also we wanted to try to take advantage of some of the skill set we had. Our quarterback is really good at RPOs and some of those things. We evolved more with that. We had some receivers that could do certain things. And that's how you evolve without losing that identity of making that defensive coordinator have to defend our dive game, our quarterback, and our pitch. What's crazy, you know, this past year, as far as true option plays, triple option plays, we ran a total of five times. Now, you'd think no way in the world. Now, did we run more like double options? And yeah, we'd run more of those, but true triple type plays, we only ran a total of five times. But because we have it in, it gives us a chance to try to take advantage of what some other defenses are trying to give us. And that's how we've evolved with our passing game and can be able to BYU game. We threw the ball for a total of 85 yards. The next week we threw over 320. And so we try to do what the defense gives us. And if they try to take away certain things, then we're going to try to, you know, win the way we can win.
How many different option plays do you guys actually have in your playbook?
We probably have different variances, about five total. We have an inside veer, we have an outside veer, we have a midline, we have a speed option, we have a counter option. We have about five to six variances of it. Now, there's different things you can do off of it, but we have those in, and then each week we'll have a wrinkle off of those, and we'll try to see how defense, what they align and which version of that option we think works, which will work. Now, I've had upwards of 8 to 10 before, and we've scaled down because of some of the different things you can do. But we're always going to probably carry in 5 to 6 different option plays, different, completely different schemes in that game. And then there might be where we need to run one of them a bunch and not use as many of the other ones. But I want to make sure we have that in case, you know, somebody's that much better than us and we got to try to find a way to move the ball.
I mean, what really stood out about watching that offense last year is that, you know, when you think traditionally about, like you said, service academy type offenses or, Georgia Tech when they're running it, like the quarterbacks don't pass very often. And so they're just seen as they're not very good passers. But Grayson McCall is a great passer. And how much did his, you know, he's a redshirt freshman last year. How much did his taking over that offense just kind of open up more possibilities for what you could do?
Well, when you're calling plays, you only call plays you trust that your quarterback can make happen. And there's a bunch of plays out there you think would work, but if your quarterback can't execute it, you get sort of nervous. Hey, he's going to make a bad decision. With Grayson, even from the get-go, there was a confidence that if we called something and it was a bad play, he was going to figure out a way to make it right. And the thing that he's got that I'm just unbelievably impressed with from a young perspective is, one, he's got some moxie and some poise about him that for a young guy in the pocket, you don't see a lot. And you can't get under his skin. He's very thick skin-wise, and he handles himself. And two, his accuracy is unbelievable. I mean, there and games and throwing in tight windows, The accuracy that he displays at a young age is as good as I've been around. And so from a standpoint of a coach, then you feel more confident saying, hey, let's let this guy go a little bit. You don't have to run as much option plays and different things because you feel he's going to be able to give you a chance to make the right decisions and right plays. And as he kept going on during the season, we put, you know, more and more on him early on. I tried to, you know, limit some packages as much as we could, just so we didn't overblow his fuse and let him go out there and play. And as we kept going, he wanted more and more. You know, we had two guys that played before him that were both on the team. They were going to be juniors. They both started over the last couple of years. Both started probably 7-8 games and played a lot. And during this pandemic, he logged more hours of watching video and doing the things that a quarterback should do than any of them combined. I mean, he is a football junkie. And what most people don't realize about him, he did go through spring practice, but when we came back in July, the first time we were able to get back in July was July 6th. That's when we tested. He was quarantined up until July 28th. So he missed all of July. And the first time that he came back was early August, right when we were starting fall camp. He was behind from a perspective of that. And one of our perceived starter going into the year hurt his Achilles during camp and missed about, 7 to 10 practices. And Grayson got more and more reps. And then once he got those reps, he took off. And we made the decision a week before the Kansas game, or 2 weeks, whenever we made that decision, was, hey, this guy gives us the best chance to win a championship. And I knew, he might make some mistakes here or there, but we were willing to live with him because his ceiling. And I think he turned the ball over a total of 6 times the whole year in 10, 11 games, 3 interceptions. I think he maybe had 2 fumbles, maybe 3. So he was well beyond advertised.
How much now that everyone now knows about Coastal Carolina, maybe it's, I want to say at one point people in your region obviously knew who you guys were, but now because of the year you had, how much have other people around college football going, hey, I'd love to pick your brain about your offense and things? And how do you, like, I remember when Leach got rolling with the air raid, it was like almost some people wanted to be protective about, hey, who we're letting in. And Leach would talk to almost anybody. How have you managed being kind of the hip, cutting edge offensive guy now?
Well, I'll be honest. I like sort of being out of the spotlight because it was unique and nobody else wanted to do it, and so you were the only one doing it, And so nobody really cared about it that much. Now a lot more people want to find out what we're doing, and truth be told, it's for myself. It's all stolen as well. It's not like I created it. Obviously, people have done it. So we've tried to be as open as we can about it. And in today's age, everybody's got your video now. Used to, it was hard to get your video, but now everybody has it. So not many people know your secrets. I think the challenge with this offense, truthfully, is what I share with people. It's easy with the air raid because you're throwing it, right? You're getting receivers and you're throwing it. With this one, you got to, your identity and who you are, it starts really with a run game. And we try to make it a physical power type run game and saying, hey, our run game is going to be based off of these principles. And you have to buy into that. Doesn't mean you can't RPO. Doesn't mean you can't do all those things. You really want to do some of these things. That there's a mentality there. And you've got to be able to, as that defensive coordinator mentioned to you, you got to be able to say, hey, my answers are going to be X, Y, Z when they do this to me. And so that's why, in my opinion, a lot of people haven't gone to it as much previously because, they're worried about, well, you have to do this, you have to do that. And I think now we're showing them you can throw the ball 30-something times a game and still have some off-space principles like we have. And so we've been open about it. We're actually getting ready to have Thursday night, we're getting ready to have a clinic, and that thing sold out in like 10 minutes. As far as I say sold out, it was free, but just people wanting to know. And that's why we're doing it, because, hopefully that's the good thing. We get labeled as America's team right now. More and more people are learning about Coastal Carolina. And you said the region knew about us. I don't know if anybody in our states really knew about it, but the success that Clemson's had and obviously with South Carolina being in here as well. But that's been just so huge for us, is now the attention that we've gotten and the way our guys play and the fun that we've had. That's been huge for us. And just the development of our program and trying to become a consistently top program in the Sun Belt. Sun Belt's really good football. And I think some people that follow it knew, but I think most people now, if you watch, you're thinking, hey, that's a good brand of football there. And if we can, start being mentioned with the likes of the top teams in our league consistently, I'm thankful for that and the attention that we're receiving.
The BYU game last year was obviously the kind of the pinnacle of that. And it was one of these, perfect storm, you know, for that matchup to come together like it did, and the fact that game day was already planning to come to town. And I truly believe it was the best game of the regular season last year in all of college football. Everybody, people who would have no vested interest in either team were, you know, gravitated to that throughout the day. What did it do for you guys exposure wise in terms of maybe you're now hearing from recruits you never would have heard before, things like that?
Well, from that standpoint, from a recruiting standpoint, having game day here and then the way the game turned out, I mean, that opened so many doors for us. You know, most of our 21 class was basically finished at that point, and, you know, we were 2 weeks out from December. And so it didn't really affect that. But what it has done for 22s from all over really the country now, it is more and more people recognize that name and recognize that brand, and that opened it up. Now, we have every 5'9" center in the country. I can tell you that because of our 5'9" center. But I tell you what I was most impressed with out of the game. Yes, recruiting. I had more random fans just from wherever email and just say, hey, I'm just a college football fan, don't know much about, you know, Coastal Carolina, but that was one of the most enjoyable games that I've ever seen. And just thank you for the type of way that game was played and the team and how you guys' team played. We needed something positive within, you know, for what we're going through in this country. And I had more of those throughout the season, but specifically after that BYU game. I had somebody send us I had somebody from Kansas after the season or after the game sent me an unbelievable Shauna Clearhead that he made on his own, just saying, hey, I lost my wife and I'm a college football fan. And your team gave me joy this year just watching y'all play. Didn't know much about you. And so you really see the value of sports, obviously, and what it brings to be. It does unite us in a lot of ways. And I think after that, just because it was such national recognition, you know, you saw so much more of that people didn't know much about, you know, Coastal, just from all over the country reaching out and just talking about that game. And they must have had bet a lot of money on us, is the only thing I got. But it was that really, I think, and I knew how important sports are to us because that's what we do, right? But then just other people outside of that and seeing that was – I'll take that memory, you know, for the rest of my life. It's just the way the game played and game day and all those things. It was just something special.
Jamie, this is something that I think I had mentioned to Stu a while back, but – one of the ways you really first got on my radar in the beginning of the pandemic, there was a night I remember early on where I was putting our kids to bed where I just kind of like wait till they get to sleep and just kind of scroll through the internet. And I had seen a tweet that you had put out, and it was really related to a tragedy in Georgia, and it was the Ahmaud Arbery case. For people who don't know it, it was a young black man who was killed while going for a run. And I remembered you commented on a news story about it. And I thought, okay, it was interesting because that was one of the time, I think it was before a lot of people, at least in football, coaches were really speaking out on some of these issues. And so I started reading more about you. And I came across a story from a few years earlier. It's funny because our colleague Grace Rayner had done it. It was basically about how you had met your wife early on. It was Grace had done it at a previous job. And so I started asking Grace about you. And she told me some really, you know, really cool things about you and your family and kind of your background and your perspective on things. Before we get into the football stuff, I did want us to touch on your role as a leader and kind of how you've used social media, as well as kind of what this year has been like for you with so many different kind of a whirlwind of emotions, from being like a darling of college football, but at the beginning of all this, of how you've kind of been a voice for your program.
Well, my family, and especially my wife, does have a unique story. And, you know, I was taught from a young age, from my mom especially, that you're to use your voice for those that don't have a voice. And I know that I have been a college football coach and being at smaller levels up to now, you always have a platform and you can use it for good or you can use it for harm. And I've always tried to one, be thankful for the position I have, but two, make sure that if there's an opportunity to speak up against or for something that I believe is right or believe is wrong, I feel like I'm compelled to do that with the position that I have, and especially with the group of young men that I'm fortunate to coach. You know, majority of those are minorities, and a lot of those have come from difficult and certain circumstances, and I try to make sure that I empathize with where they're at and what they go through, and I never have all the answers, but I want to make sure that I'm giving them the opportunity to voice their concern, voice their opinions about certain things. And I feel like social media gives you that opportunity, but I also want to make sure that I'm doing it in a way that's respectful, that can draw on dialogue, and that we can have open and honest conversations about what we're going through as a country, and maybe what my players are experiencing or feeling through those time frames, that I can help be a voice for them and give them the platform to be educated enough to go out and share with that. And my wife, you know, has a unique experience with it as well, because she came from Iran, a country that does not have democracy. She was born there and raised there a little bit, and then moved to America when the revolution went on, and so she's experienced a lot of things firsthand, being from a different country and being Middle Eastern, especially during the time frame back during 9/11, when a lot went on with, you know, terrorism, and she obviously represents or very looks much like somebody from that region, and so she went through a lot of that as well. So I've got a unique perspective from her and her upbringing and the things that she had to go through, and so I've tried to make sure that I have an open ear and more importantly, I think, an open heart to try to empathize with different people that went through different things that I never experienced growing up. I grew up in a small town in East Tennessee, and so a lot of the things that I've seen today or experienced, I didn't have that experience, but it doesn't mean that I can't try to put myself in those positions. And as I said, speak up for those that might not have the chance to speak.
Jamie, after that, this season, I know, and Stu and I talked about this more than once, about when there was a head coaching vacancy and there was a bunch in your area, and your name was connected to it in one way or another, I think he and I both felt that would be a good hire for them, whoever it was going to be, because of your ties to those particular areas, because of your offense, because there was a lot of reasons why people would look at it and go, yeah, that would make a lot of sense for, quote, them, whoever them was. Whether it could have been Tennessee, whether it could have been South Carolina, whether it could have been UCF. And we're not just saying this because you're on with us now. I mean, these are conversations we had over the last couple of months. I'm curious. So one of the things that would get brought up is, well, he's never coached at the Power Five level. From your perspective on things, do you think that whatever you guys did there, are doing at Coastal, and it's a lot of guys on your staff, your defensive coordinator has done a tremendous job this past year. And I think, you know, during the Kansas game, he got a, you know, people were like, oh, this, you know, they got some good players. They got good players and they play really hard. They play really fast. So people saw this. I mean, how much do you feel like, hey, this is wherever we go, and I'm going to try to bring my guys with me on staff if we do get the chance. Do you feel even more confident now about what you have after last year than kind of seeing it? Or where was your takeaway from? Because obviously your name was attached to a lot of things, about where you feel like your career is headed.
Well, that is the, I guess if it's the knock is, hey, you've never been at this level, you can't win at this level, et cetera. And, my answer always to that is, listen, I've been a head coach four times, Division II, FCS, and now here. And everywhere that we've been has been either a rebuild job or a job just trying to get something going, less resources, all these things. And we found a way to win. And at the end of the day, the reason why you're hiring people is you're not winning with who you have currently, right? And your alumni, everybody wants you to start winning. And so I actually believed in ourselves and believed in what we did. I knew we would find a way to turn around here and get this GOAT program going in the direction. And I feel wholeheartedly we're just getting started with it. This is, I was the interim in 17, and last year was taking over for Coach Mobley at Knights. We're really strong about the foundation that we have. And I feel confident in our core group of guys on our staff that we've been together for a long time. And all those places that we've been that we've turned around, we've done that together. And it's playing hard and having good coaches and doing those little things right. And I believe wholeheartedly it'd work at that level. You know, the challenge from what I, you know, what I'm gathered is, you know, they Power Five. And again, I've never been there. Never. I was not, whether it was fortunate or unfortunate, never had the chance to be at that level and coach, whether it's a GA or assistant or anything. That's just not been the path that I've had. I sort of had to create it on my own. You know, I didn't play at a high level. I didn't play for a famous coach. And so you sort of had to create it on your own. And so I've tried to share in any of those opportunities I've had to share is that I feel strongly how you build a program. It's about your culture. You win with culture, and yes, talent, you know, you want to get as much talent, but you win with culture and the way your team plays and the way they go about handling themselves. And I feel like we've shown that over the last, you know, I think this is my 11th year being a head coach, in year, whatever it may be. And I value winning. And sometimes I guess winning is not enough if you've not done it at a high enough level, you know? And so that's not for me to judge, but I feel strongly that, that we know what it takes to come to a program and get the maximize the potential out of it. And when you go into sometimes like this, they might not have the built-in advantages, and you got to be the type of person that doesn't complain about it, and you find a way. And I think that's what we've done a great job of their staff was we find a way to do it. And everybody goes, how y'all doing that? You know, and it's this or that, but you get the right people, you trust them. You know that, you know, they're in it for the right reasons, that, and you have low egos. Like our staff's got low egos. We care about each other. And a lot of these guys have played for me or they've coached for me a long time. And then you know you're all pulling in the same direction. And that's how we've had success. And I have no doubt, you know, wherever the Lord takes me that, you know, here, we just signed a new long-term deal here we're excited about. And if there's another doors that open up down the road, I have no doubt it'll work there as well. You just got to get somebody to believe in that and believe in what you're doing.
Last thing, Coach, talking about this coming season, and once again, you guys started spring practice in the winter, and you've already completed your spring camp. There's teams that aren't even starting for another month. And what I think, you know, with this rule where everybody gets a free year of eligibility, and we're looking around, we're seeing just how many seniors are coming back. I mean, when I saw your guys' numbers, it's possible they're a little outdated, so I forgive me, but as of the last time I saw this, you basically only lost two starters from that great team last season, right? Like, you had 10 senior starters, and all the two came
20
back.
Right now, you know, paper-wise, we've got 20 of 22 starters back.
So only two seniors actually left, like, of those starters. Or everybody else decided to come back?
We had three total leave, mm-hmm. And two of them were, you know, one was a player of the year defensively, which is going to be hard to replace, and the other one was first-team all-conference running back, hard to replace. And then we had a receiver that rotated in. Those were the three that we lost. Everybody else from a position standpoint is coming back. And so that's a good start.
I mean, it's pretty remarkable. So what did you – I guess I would ask – usually I ask, hey, what did you guys learn from spring this year? You already knew about these guys for the most part, but, you know, what was the big takeaway about where you stand coming out of spring?
Well, you know, for us, the challenge was we got done playing our bowl game late December, and we started earlier here than normal. January 27th was actually our start date because there was no recruiting. And the purpose behind that, normally don't start that early, but our university pushed our spring break back till the beginning of April. And I was concerned if COVID did not get better that they were not going to bring anybody back to campus after that, except for maybe anybody that's in season. And so I wanted to make sure we got our off-season conditioning and our practice in. And so our mindset going into the practice this spring was, one, developing those positions. We do have a lot of people back, but there's still some guys that we need to develop in case injuries or for competition purposes. It's that second-team quarterback if something happens to the first-team guy. And so we had a lot of competitive people to put them in position in case something goes wrong, that they're ready to go out and play at a high level. And so it was really trying to find those other guys that haven't had a lot of reps, and we gave them tons of reps this spring. And so I really feel good about we've identified who that next tier is in case something goes wrong, or hopefully maybe can compete for, you know, compete to push some of the starters that are coming back. Cause I think that's the main thing is the starters coming back can't just relax. They got to feel like there's competition coming after their job as well. And then plus the positive of getting the spring, we get to work on our post game celebrations more. So we'll have some really good ones ready to rock and roll. We got more time to practice them.
Well, that's good. We can all check out your social media accounts for that. I think Stu and I both agree on this. You guys were as fun a story in what was a, you know, turbulent 2020 college football season. And it was really, like I said, I mean, you guys are fun to watch. Everything about the story, I thought, was pretty refreshing. And, you know, I think what everyone around the sport kind of knows with all the guys you have coming back, it's not a one-year wonder thing. It's probably the start of something. So, Jamie, we really appreciate your time today to join us on the Audible.
I appreciate you guys. And I did promise my team I would grow a mullet, so I'm working it out. y'all call me, or we get back together here in about a month, I'm probably going to have a mullet. So y'all might want to be
breaking news right here. We broke that story right here, right now.
Break. There you go.
All right. Thank you so much, Coach.
Thank y'all.
Thanks, Coach.
All right. You heard it here first. Jamie Chadwell, mullet in progress. We'll continue to monitor this fast developing story.
Stu, how much money would it take for you to get to grow a mullet?
True story. I had a mullet when I was 14 or so in my heavy metal days. It wasn't really called that then. I don't remember. I remember just referring to it as like my flip in the back. But there are pictures somewhere in my mom's house of 14-year-old Stuart with his mullet.
Ooh, we need to see those pictures.
See what I can dig up. We ran out of time, unfortunately, for emails this week. We will double up on them next week. Send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.